Hello and welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, on Smart Speaker, and of course on our podcast. I'm Amy Packham and we're doing the double over the Dutch in association with oldfootballshirts.com. Yes, well, after the euphoria of beating Ajax in Amsterdam last Thursday, came the damp squib that was the draw against Sheffield United on Sunday. I'm not sure if the players were as jaded as a lot of those in the stands, but if we had been able to add to Simon Adingra's wonder goal, then we would be having a very difficult conversation right now. And maybe, just maybe, Roberto would be saying that he only hates 70% of the English refs. So then, the international break has come at a good time so we can get some of our walking wounded back up and running. And it's certainly a list that we would like to see reduced very quickly. In other news, Evan Ferguson has put pen to paper to extend his contract until 2029. And the Albion women's team recorded a historic victory away at Manchester City on Sunday. Joining me today is, of course, Alan Wares. And we're delighted, as ever, to welcome back Andy Bass. Hello, chaps. How are we?
I'm fine. More to the point, and I think this is the exciting bit. As a Brighton fan, I'm going to ask this of my fellow Brighton fans. How was your away day in Amsterdam?
It was fantastic. Thank you for asking.
Very tiring.
Yes, I think it's tiring.
The thing about any given away day is that, you know, I think it's one of those things where a lot of kids, boys mainly, but maybe some girls as well, they learn their geography of England by knowing where football grounds are. I certainly did. I mean, to that extent, I had no idea where Worcester was or Harrogate was or, I don't know, Western Superman, where it was, because they didn't have a league club. But, you know, I knew where Paul Vale was and I knew where Grimsby was. And you go on these away days and you'll go and see some of these, some towns and cities are absolutely beautiful. Some are grey. But Amsterdam must have been one of the sexiest places Brighton have ever played, surely.
Yeah, it was the trip was everything we wanted it to be. It was fantastic from beginning to end, really.
You weren't there, right?
Planes at the beginning of the trip were working fine. You know, when you have to rely on a quarter to six train on Southern Rail, you on Thames, you are really taking a little bit of a chance. And I think once that was on time, you thought the omens were good. And just an absolutely wonderful trip from beginning to end. Amsterdam is a fantastic city. I haven't been there for about, I don't know, 25 years or so, but it's pretty much as I remember it. Just wonderful. Everybody there was really, really nice. Thought the organisation on the match day was fantastic. And the steps to get up to the away end actually made the walk on Sunday up the West End upper stairs seem like a.
Well, it's the only thing they have to climb in the Netherlands, isn't it?
It was brilliant. The atmosphere was great. Just saw so many people. There's just so many people out there. Just like you couldn't walk for 5 minutes without bumping into someone that you knew. Absolutely.
So, actually, that raises an interesting point there, Andy. I couldn't put it into terms of other away clubs or clubs that go, but given what we had 15 years ago and all the campaigning, 15, 20 years ago, all the campaigning and the marches and the protests and what have you, do you think, and there's probably no way of knowing this, do you think more Brighton fans know each other than, say, other fans of other clubs know each other?
That's quite an interesting point.
I would say yes.
I'm going to say yeah. I think because basically, so the end of the gold, obviously the war years and the Goldstone, but also the beginning of like the Wittdean years. It was quite a close knit community, and certainly where we sit in the West End Upper, it's because of the way that they sold the season tickets to begin with.
Yeah,
the group that sit there, we know most of the people around us anyway. So, and lots of them were in Amsterdam last week. And even if we weren't hanging out with them, we certainly saw them at the match. And it was great. And yeah, it's still, that's what I've always thought about Brighton, even at the Amex. I still think there is that sense of camaraderie and community that's been there for, the best part of 20 years. Yeah. 20 years that I've been watching the Albion anyway.
Even for the home games, at the Amex, I mean, notwithstanding all the people you sit around who you may or may not be on nodding terms with, but when you have the beers before the game and you have your beers after the game, there's always 50, 60, 70, maybe 100 people that you know. Yeah. And that's without trying. That's just by standing still.
Yeah, no, it's great. And it was like that on Thursday. And that's why it was really special. Obviously, I did go to Marseille, and that was an amazing experience for people that went. But I think this is the one that people are looking forward to. It's like, Marseille is exciting and it's going to be a unique experience, and which is how it turned out. But this is, if the Albion fans could have picked a name out of that, were given a name to pick out of the hat themselves, I'm pretty sure 90% of people would have been picking out Ajax.
Yeah.
I mean, there were other names as well in the hat there that,
Roma, but this was the one that we wanted. Possibly
this one is probably culturally closest. To Brighton,
because Ajax is such a, they're on their uppers at the moment, but such a legendary name,
four times European champion,
all history. The fact that Amsterdam itself is just an absolutely fantastic place to visit, and it's really easy to get to. So even if you didn't have a ticket, you could go and have a good time. And judging by the videos I've seen, it looks like everybody was in the bars watching the match. Had an absolute riot as well. And it was just terrific.
Now, Aidy, you had to tear yourself away from that a little bit in terms of, I understand that you stayed at some flop joint in King's Cross before heading over to, the sea, it was under the sea. So you got to Amsterdam, I guess, probably just about in time. But you and a company called Under the Lights hosted a lunchtime comedy session. Sounded like it was not far short of sold out. And again, there was a fair few people who you knew there that you didn't know were going to be there. So give us a rundown of that particular entertainment.
Well, yeah, it was a very different experience. I mean, I was up at 3:30 in the morning, partly because I couldn't sleep and partly because I didn't want to miss a train. You have that anxiety.
That's terrible, isn't it?
If I miss this train, this could go horribly wrong. And yeah, so I got the 6 o'clock train, and it was there's a sprinkling of Albion fans on it, but it was like actually a lot emptier than I thought it might have been actually the whole train. And I got over there and I was messaging Steve Grant, who was doing the show with me, and unlike you, Andy, he had a bit of an issue because his train was cancelled.
Yeah, it was a bit more mine.
And basically, he had to get a flight out of London City, and it was a race against time about whether he was actually going to make it or not. And bearing in mind, he was very much a massive part of the show. If he didn't make it, then we were in massive trouble.
Your comic turn if he didn't make it, though, AD.
Well, there was a chance that I was going to have to do stand up, and it wouldn't be the first time. And there's a reason why there wasn't the second time.
I'm really
but I was prepared.
Wasn't there.
I would have done it. But yeah, so we got over there. It was a really lovely venue in the IDOC, just down the road from Amsterdam Central Station. And thank you so much to everybody that came along. It was really well supported. And I think everyone that went had a really good show. And I believe it probably actually was, from experience, it was probably the cheapest beer we found in Amsterdam.
Was the show, was the actual event recorded?
Bits of it will come out. There was a camera there, but it was only recording bits to put a compilation together for to try and get sponsors for it.
Okay.
But you know what? It was one of the, I mean, what will happen is, I recorded a load of videos with some Albion legends before there, and we'll try and get those up on YouTube for you. So they're worth listening to because they were very funny. But
great stuff. So just give us a flavour of the running water. Tell us what happened. I mean, was it you opening the show or?
One of the guys from Under the Lights, David Alfie Ward, he opened it. And Whammo, who I know listens to this, he had a lovely time. Didn't you, Whammo? And he was the butt of a few jokes, I believe.
Oh, he did put himself front and center to be picked.
Yeah, he was in the front row. And then Steve Grant came on, did his turn. And it was interspersed with the interviews I did with the likes of Brian Hall and Adam Virgo, Dale Stevens, Kerry Mayo and Gary Nelson. So they were up on the screen in between the acts. And then we did a live roar with Brian Owen and Steve Grant. And we talked about our favourite ever Albion goals. I put out some slips beforehand to get suggestions from people, thinking, well, I think I know how this is going to go. We're going to get, there's probably going to be a clear winner of what's going to happen here. How wrong was I? We had 27 different nominations.
Now, was your rule that it was a goal that you had to have been at, or one you've seen on telly, or was it one that before? What was your rule on that?
Finally, we did interview Gary Nelson. Now you mention it.
Yeah, but what was your rule for asking people for their favourite goal?
There was no right answer. That was the only.
All right. Thing. So in that case, what would your answer going to be?
Do you choose the most aesthetically pleasing goal? Is the best goal the most important, or is it the most aesthetically pleasing? Because we all know what the most important goal in our history was, and that would be Ryan Apps. Yeah. And that was the clear winner on the day. But obviously, Gary Nelson came up. Obviously, there was quite a few others. Willie Irvine, Jimmy Case had a few in there.
Which Jimmy Case won?
Both. Well, there's three nominations for him. There was the Sheffield Wednesday game. There was the
Liverpool.
Anfield and Norwich.
Got ya. Anyone? Okay, so Andy, what would your answer have been?
You put me on the spot here. I don't think I could come up with one, to be honest.
Okay. Come back to that then later.
Historically, even though it was before my time, I do like the Jimmy Case one. It was always noteworthy, even...
In the cup semi-final, you mean?
In the cup semi-final, yeah. Because just seeing someone whack it in front of your own fans.
Let's get on to the game itself, because, it was a momentous occasion, Andy. And it was the first time, I think it was the first time I've seen the game indoors.
Yes. Yeah. And thank goodness, because the weather was utterly foul. it basically chucked it down, pretty much the whole time we were there. And... so thankfully the roof has left on. Apparently, because the Albion trained under the roof the previous day, it meant that the match had to be played under similar conditions. So
really?
Yeah, I don't. Yeah, that's just what somebody was saying at the game. There, it's like a UEFA rule or something. So so they had to keep the roof on. But to be honest, I think they kept it on anyway because the weather was shocking. Hmm. It was. I mean. We got in there quite early, very lively metro ride up to the stadium, and we were lucky enough not to have to queue too long to get through the security to get into the stadium. But yeah, so we were there nice and early, took up our positions, just took in the surroundings. We had a tremendous view where we were. I mean, that section we were in was...
You were on the top shelf, weren't you?
Yeah, we were, but you kind of didn't feel, even though there was a lot of steps, you kind of didn't feel that remote from the game. You had a brilliant, brilliant view of it. And
well, the upper tier is quite steep there, isn't it? It's famously quite steep, isn't it?
Yeah, this was my only concern, was it was steep. People were drinking beers in the stadium. So the whole thing was quite slippery. So my main concern, like when we scored, I was grabbing the back of my seat to make sure I wasn't going to like tumble down about three rows in front of me. But it was very steep, but it was flipping awesome. And pre-match was great. They had the old light show, and they were blasting out of Pensiero from Nabucco as their warm-up music, which I thought was absolutely amazing.
You might have to explain that one, Andy.
Well, it's a sort of de facto Italian national anthem, but it's to do with really... sort of the Jewish ties with Ajax. That song is quite pertinent to that side of it, and it's an absolute classic. So me and my friend Brent, we were going, Pensiero, brilliant, love it.
what actually is a vegan prawn sandwich, Andy?
Well, I don't know, you can get vegan prawns, so
what are they made of?
Yeah. Probably Sawyer.
Right.
But, okay, I mean, the stadium itself, Andy, I obviously I was in a different part of it to you, up in the press area there, and I actually got to go through a lot of the home stands and have a good look around. And one thing that I noticed that they did do really, really well was the history of the club. You got a real sense of the place, and obviously it's the Johan Cruyff Arena, and there's lots of like busts and statues and pictures of him and all over the place, and obviously all their legends all over the place. It was you know, there was a proper, you know, you really got a feel for the place.
Yeah, it's less of that in the away end. It was just rather prosaic trudge up the stairs, but yeah, I mean it was great, and yeah, the atmosphere was interesting to begin with. I didn't really think from where we were the Ajax fans were that loud, so it was quite nice for us to be able to sing and for it not to feel like the pointless exercise it felt in Marseille at times.
It's good to, but I think if we get onto the game itself, I think what was pleasing was it was a game that we won where actually Ajax did bother turning up this time. You know, the game at the Amex was, well, it was, I wouldn't say it was a shambles or a farce or a mockery of a sham, but that was an Ajax. It wasn't so much on their uppers. It was actually, they're on their knees. When you're playing European giants, you expect a bit more. So at least when the game in Amsterdam, it was a bit more of an even Stevens tie. And, you know, like I say, they actually, you know, you could still see them wanting, but they actually did bother to turn up this time.
Well, was there eight different managers that we've had since then? No, it's just the two. But this was, yeah, but the current incumbent was, you know, he came out and he said, you know, we're going to come out and we're going to be Ajax. We're going to, like, take the game to Brighton, which we thought before the game was actually going to play into our hand a little bit. And, you know, they had the best of the opening chances. And there was an early chance for Berghaus, wasn't there? But it was an easy shell.
There were a lot of range efforts, though, weren't they? So.
Yeah. But, I mean, there is a bit of a recurring theme here. Basically, after 5 minutes, Andy, we had to make a change with James Milner limping off, which basically means Billy Gilmour came into the action a lot earlier than he's probably anticipating, which meant Gross having to go into fullback.
Yeah, we were disappointed to see that because it was quite a disruption, I think, to what our attacking plans were. It also meant that Dahoud seemed to get moved along one in midfield, and he actually started the game, I thought, really well.
Yeah.
And then sort of Billy Gilmour sort of came in and, say, took over for a bit, the sort of the bulk of the work in that area of the pitch, and actually his first sort of 10 to 15 minutes, I didn't think he was that good. He was a bit sloppy. It was only later on in the game that he really started to get hold of it and really play well, which he did in the last hour of the game. I thought he played well. But
I think it was actually, for me, Dahoud has been, well, we'll talk about what happened on, you know, later, but I think for the last three or four games, Dahoud has been our best central midfielder.
Yeah.
There's been a lot of them.
Yes. He's been playing well, but then having to see Gross go back to left back was disappointing because we were losing him there, and obviously it's bad for Milner, who's, you know, who's put a shift in. I mean, I think not a lot of us are massive fans of him in that fullback position, but he clearly disrupted us for a short while, and yeah, Ajax came out swinging. I mean, they, you know. They went around, had a look where the kitchen sink was, picked it up and decided to throw it at us all night. And it was a good contest. I mean, funny enough, it's one of those rare Albion games where it's what we did out of possession that seemed to be better than what we did in possession. And I thought we controlled the pace of the game really, really well. I thought we always made it comfortable for ourselves. It was a really sort of impressive a mature performance from the Albion. I just thought we really looked like we were, you know, confident in ourselves.
Well, it's the last two and a half European games we've actually looked like we know how to defend. If I only could put that kind of form into the Premier League at the moment. Yeah. But, you know, since about the 40th minute within Marseille, we've actually looked a decent European side. for all that Ajax tried to throw us, we were keeping them for a fair amount of time at arm's length until such time as one of their youngsters made a bit of a dropsy.
Yeah, so Vos' pass was intercepted by Dingra, who played in Fati, who gave the Albion the lead, Andy. And Ansu Fati is just one of those players. And you keep saying, don't fall in love with a lone player. Don't fall in love with a lone player. But, you know, you see how much it actually means to him. And you saw it again on Sunday when Adingra scored that wonder goal that, you know, he's part of that team. He's part of that close-knit community. He's one of us.
Yeah, I mean, he's been terrific the last few games. He's really warming up. You know, our job is to rehabilitate him for the benefit of Barcelona, and we're doing a great job of it. he's having a fine old time. And as soon as that ball, like before the goal, we always looked like we were going to threaten to pounce on something rather than create. We looked like we were like quite close to sort of like nicking something away from them and having a chance. And then that is actually, you know, how the goal came about. But as soon as he went in between, as soon as he got into that area, it was just no way he wasn't going to score. And we had just like the perfect view of it.
Well, he was perfectly set up after that first touch. That first touch was everything. And it set it up. It took it away from the defender enough. You know, thankfully the pass from Adingra was perfectly weighted. How many through balls have we seen lately that have just gone straight through to the keeper? That through ball was perfectly weighted. Fatty's first touch was superb. The second one took it away from the defender. The third one tucked into the corner. I mean, all right, yes, the setup we were given a bit of a gift, but you know that's what happens at this level. And hey, we're at that level, so it was, you know, the commentator's thing of, well, he still had work to do. He did. I mean, he was still 35 yards out, but he gave the defender a clean pair of heels and made the goalkeeper, I thought, look a bit of a mug. I mean, there was nothing wrong with what the goalkeeper did. He just made him look stupid.
Yeah. He's just got this weird way of kicking a ball, hasn't he, Andy? He kind of like punches
the goal.
It. Yeah, no, because, I mean, we'll come to when we talk about like the Sheffield United game, the weekend, where sometimes you just want him to put his laces through it, but it's like he just kind of like punches it like into the corner. He doesn't really. It's like passing it like as if he's just passing it 10 yards or something. It's just such an accurate way of doing it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he had a little bit of room. He created the space for himself to have like, you know, pretty much do what he wanted with that shot. But it was so smoothly done. And I think that's a real theme with a lot of our goals now. They just sort of, we sort of glide them in. He's terrific. I think, you know, you can see the experience that he's got at that high level.
Yes. And finally, I mean, and even then, you still know there's more to come from him. I think even De Zerbia said he's only playing about 60% of his, how he can quantify it, I don't know, but he's only playing at 60% of his capabilities. So, and don't get me wrong, obviously De Zerbi is a taskmaster and he wants so much more out of his players. But I think even then, we can see that there's still more to come. I want to see him go on a run like Adingra did. I mean, I thought he was supposed to be doing that for Barcelona. So let's have him doing that for us, you know.
Yeah.
I demand satisfaction.
Okay, so we took the lead, Andy, and Ajax had a chance possibly to have... I think it was a penalty, is his thing. When Dunk, basically, I mean, we've seen so many weird, convoluted refereeing decisions this one. But basically, I've seen it from various different angles. When I was staying in Holland with the Dutch Seagulls. Hello, Werner. We're watching the highlights on the Dutch television. They're showing this from every conceivable angle, and I can't see how it wasn't given, to be honest.
It looked like a foul to me. I thought the referee was good all night. I thought,
really? You think Pedro's yellow card was justified?
They were looking for. There was an air of desperation about Ajax, I thought, and they were clearly looking for it. Robbie was trying to buy fouls off Van Heck all night. I thought the that contest between those two was just terrific entertainment.
Fantastic, wasn't it?
For the whole two. They were both going at hammering songs, two very physical players. And you know, Robbie was just like, I think he just wanted everything from the ref. And I just think the referee wasn't having it, basically. I think he was fairly consistent.
Apart from Pedro, red, yellow card.
Well, mate, yeah, apart from that, maybe, but you can't have everything, can you?
But okay, well, there was I mean similar to Jingery, he's one of those players, he brings joy to the party, doesn't he? He just plays with a smile on his face, and it's like he just looked cheeky.
Well,
and
I was watching the comment, obviously I was watching it at home. Terrified of the fact that it was Robbie Savage was the co-commentator. But thankfully we didn't get his histrionics that we got from when West Ham were in the Europa Conference League final, when he was really going off on one. But it was actually, obviously, you know, him being an ex-player, albeit only for about 5 minutes. But what we were talking about just ahead of the second goal was that Brighton were kind of getting into their mojo a bit. And obviously, well, we're a team that usually, apart from Sunday, turns up in the second half rather than the first half. So in this instance, we're starting to play those little short passes that drive the other team around the twist. And then there's this lovely little turn around the corner from Dahoud, which releases Fatty, and off he goes.
Oh, you're ahead of me here. I'm still in the first half here.
Well, but, we really left in the first half to talk.
Right, and
we must move on. We've got to move on. You know, it was a classic kind of Brighton pseudo counter-attack, in as much as they'd suckered the attacking team in. I think that it's the last three goals now that have only featured as scorers and assists, Adingra and Fatty now, isn't it? I mean,
this is what I was alluding to. I mean, there was the chance in the first half where Adingra again was running it at the Ajax offence. He played a 1-2 with Fatty, and he very nearly beat the goalkeeper at the near post. And but you're right. You know, there is this little relationship they've got, and you can see it with Matoma as well. And Fassi, he's just making those players look better at times. But yeah, I mean that Andy, that was
that must have been limbs, surely.
Well, I'm going to just read to you what it says here. Dahoud finds Fatty, who runs in the Ajax defence, who back off, and he finds Adingra, who finishes with.
Oh, he didn't really say that, did he? Fantastic. But up in the gods, Andy, it must have been limbs.
It was insane. I was clinging onto my seat for dear life to avoid plummeting to my what would have been rather joyous doom at that particular point. It was just brilliant. Delirium. Utter delirium. The wide-eyed looks on just sheer joy of on everybody's face. I mean, even the whole thing was very emotional, and there was a sense of like the journey to this point was just like the disbelief that we were even here. It was just brilliant, and the atmosphere was brilliant. Slight admonishment from the PA about the throwing of beer cups to the celebrations for the goal, which, to be honest, did irritate me a little bit. But you know, if you're not going to chuck a beer, then when are you going to chuck one? But it was
your opportunity.
Yeah, it was utterly tremendous. I mean, and to be honest, then I thought two was probably enough. I thought if we could get to like the 85th minute or something without conceding a goal, then I thought we'd probably see it out. However,
yeah, our goal led a charm life of that.
And then like Ajax really came to life. This is why, you know, it wasn't so much one of our better footballing performances, but it was just a solid response to an opponent that was just really chucking everything at us. It was a really good performance from the Albion. I just thought, amazing.
Well, they did throw the kitchen sink at it, and obviously they had the opportunity to hit both posts as well. But don't forget, Pascal Grossini scored from a corner twice, which was like more of that, please, Pascal. You know, actually, a corner which we score from. My God, that would be insane. And then there was a chance where Mitoma really should have, like, put either he should have finished or he should have passed. Basically, Ferguson was in Acres and, like, he was waiting for a tap in and he took the shot himself. And he was in, you kind of feel like he was caught in two minds, do I pass, do I shoot? And then by which point it was too late.
I personally think he took the right decision to shoot. It's just such a poor shot. I think if he'd have squared it, I think that there was defender who was basically trying to swap shorts with Ferguson might well have slid in. So I think that it was the right decision to take the shot. And we've seen him do better from there. So, you know, I mean, he didn't even get close to the goal and he was, yeah, it was a poor finish.
Yeah. And the other thing here, Andy, was, I mean, obviously we had Lewis Dunk didn't make it out for the second half. And then Purvis Estupiñán came on. And then Purvis Estupiñán went off. It just seems to be just more walking wounded.
Yeah, I mean, the Dunk one was very concerning. I thought the fact that he was able to negotiate the last 5 minutes of the first half gave us hope that the injury wasn't as serious as it could be. Because I think if he'd really done something to the muscle, there's no way he was going to finish that half as comfortably as he did. But we were not surprised to see him, you know, move to the bench in the second half because he just can't take any chances with the captain. With Estupiñán, I was really surprised to see him come on. I wasn't really sure of the logic of that. And to be honest, I didn't think he was moving that great when he came on. And I think about 2 or 3 minutes maybe before he actually went down with the injury, there was what he just made a little turn sort of in the middle of the pitch. He was trying to like shape around the ball or just like move towards the ball. And he seemed to like plant his foot and then maybe like his knee kind of stayed where it was. And he just seemed to have a little twinge, nothing too big, but you just thought that didn't look comfortable for him. And I'm just wondering, why did we risk putting him out there in this game when we probably didn't need to? We could have kept his powder dry. I just thought it was an unnecessary risk. And then when he actually went down in the end, I wasn't surprised at all.
I think it's just the case, Andy, managing people's minutes still. I mean, we're doing it with most of the players at the moment, just trying to manage their workload. And if he would have obviously done all the fitness tests and everything, and the medical staff wouldn't have put him out there if they didn't think he was fit. But, you know, we've seen this with Lallana coming off straight away. We've seen it.
No, it's the same injury, though, that he went off with.
No, we don't. I re-listened to the game on BBC Sounds actually today. And
right.
Yeah, Warren Aspinall seemed to be convinced that it wasn't the same injury that he picked up before. So hopefully it was just a little tweak. De Zerbi said is quite dour about it afterwards, but he said he didn't think the injuries were that serious for Milner, Dunk or Estupiñán, but I could probably do with the 2 weeks off, to be honest.
Absolutely. But maybe that's because Warren was just enjoying the two stroke waffles I'd just given him from Werner. Johnny only got one, by the way. He got two.
he did mention that.
But you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. As ever, we're brought to you in association with oldfootballshirts.com. And Phil has given us an interesting shirt to have a look at this week from OFS. So, Andy, have a go describing this one for me.
Well, if Evel Knievel had a football team...
That's what I thought.
He'd be wearing this shirt. So we have basically a white body on the shirt, and then on the shoulders and just around the collar, we have a flash of blue with stars, resplendent with stars. I mean, seriously, just it looks like an Evel Knievel football shirt. It's
shorts come as big wide flares.
Yeah, the badge seems to be like a duck with a parachute.
Yes.
And actually, the sponsors Troy Gamer, big ugly square in the middle of the shirt because it's really, really nice. And it's a Puma shirt. It's kind of like that silky-ish sort of material, which reeks of sort of early 80s to me.
I was about to say, this is Sunday League nipple-burning material, isn't it?
Yeah, it's sort of early 80s.
I don't think it's not that kind of material. It's kind of like, it's silky, but it's kind of like what the stuff that like sticks to you and like makes you feel
good. Yeah, but on a cold winter's day in Buckingham Park or in Preston Park, that shirt's a minger.
Yeah.
I've got to be honest with you, absolutely no idea. I'm going to assume it's American, but above and beyond that, not a clue.
Well, do you want to put a year on it?
88.
No. Andy?
82.
No. Okay, well, here is what Phil has to say about this particular jersey this week. Here is your shirt of the week, and it is the 1992-93 home shirt of Zwei Bundesliga side Hertha Berlin. The team was formed in 1892 and go by the nickname of the Alte Dame, which translates to be the old lady. The side moved to the 74,649 capacity Olympiastadion in the west of Berlin in 1963, although over the years they reverted back to their old stadium, the Plumper, as well as the Poststadion, and more recently the Friedrich Ludwig van Sportpark in the early 90s. Due to the declining attendances. The record for most appearances for Hertha is held by Hungarian midfielder Pál Dárdai, who played 387 times between 97 and 2011. The top scorer is Michael Pritz, who's with 93 goals between 96 and 2003. Honours for the side include two Bundesliga titles in the 30s and two League Cups, one in 2000 and 2001. As well as numerous regional cups. A few links to the UK then. Kevin Prince Boateng began his career at Hertha in 2004 and a career covering 16 clubs. He played for Spurs, Portsmouth, and he finished his career last season at Hertha. Brian Roy was there for 3 years and in the mid-90s, and he was with Nottingham Forest for 3 years, in the mid-90s, and he moved from the City Ground to Hertha in 1997. Gabor Kirali. We have to talk about Palace players, Phil. Stepped out for Hertha 198 times before moving to that lot. And he also played for West Ham, Villa, Burnley and Fulham in a career of around 750 appearances. And a few Albion links. Thomas Kuszak began his career with Hertha in 2000. He moved to England in 2004 with West Brom, spelled for Man United and Watford, followed before signing for the Seagulls and played 84 times between 2012 and 2014. Mark Farrington even played for Hertha before he signed for Brighton in 1991, making 28 league appearances and scoring 4 goals. And current Hertha fullback is Mikhail Karbovnik, who was with us between 20 to 2023, spending most of his time out on loan without ever making a league appearance. He signed for Hertha this season, where he has clocked up 6 games so far. And bang up today, under 21 defender Noel Atom began his youth career with Hertha. He joined the Albion this season with 4 games so far in Premier League 2. So thank you for that, Phil. Of course, you can see that and over 130,000 other football shirts over at oldfootballshirts.com. Did we get blunted, Andy, against Sheffield United this week?
Yeah, we blunted ourselves in rather familiar fashion. It was very much an old school return to the days of Graham Potter, I thought, where we just, apart from one sublime moment, refused to actually shoot properly for the rest of the game. I think we kind of expected the game to go the way it did, given our record against opponents like Sheffield United, who I thought, were very industrious. But we just, we just missed too many chances. There are controversial moments in the game, but I still think, given the same circumstances, if we'd have just, sorted ourselves out in front of goal, we should have won that game quite comfortably. And it's getting to be a problem now. We're not scoring loads of goals. I mean, it's fine when you're putting three or four in the back of the net every game, you can net the odd goal in. But when you're sort of stuck on scoring one, letting one in is quite costly points-wise.
Yeah, you've got to look at the fact we have got a lot of the injury list is quite key here. I mean, and the other thing as well, the chances we created in this game, they were clear-cut chances. They weren't hard chances. These were solid goal chances. I mean,
you kind of argue against your point then, haven't you? We've got injuries, but those who did play were good enough that they, certainly in the first half, let's look at the first half, they were good enough that they carved out those chances. You know, I mean, there's, like you say, as Andy said, the Adingra goal was, you know, a piece of wonderful magic. And I think there was a slight consternation as to whether Adingra had run too quickly to pick up the 1-2, but still tucked it away in a not dissimilar fashion to the way that Fatty scored against Ajax. But, you know, there was two or three one-on-ones. There were chances there. We had shots. All right, we had a couple of long-range shots as well. But there was enough there that either once upon a time they'd have gone in, or that we'd have got a lucky deflection, or, and I'm thinking of something like Wolves. I mean, we, you know, we scored one and they went bang, 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 bang. And before you know, we've got four. If we'd have got that second goal, I think that we've got it within ourselves then to get, you know, three, four, and maybe more. But once it's getting over that hump of getting the second goal, because once they've got the second goal in the first half, I won't say we're cruising, but they can be even more adventurous. But what I felt they were doing is once we got the goal, and we were in total control in that first, total control, is that they faffed about. And it's not to say that the players couldn't do the job. Excuse me. And I think that Igor Julio is a superb stand-in for Lewis Dunk. And he showed it in the Amsterdam Arena and he showed it on Sunday. But he's kind of still not got that sort of level of creativity. He was playing at left-back and that's a slight waste of his talent. I mean, anyone who's playing at left-back that isn't Estupiñán, and it's a waste of their talent at the moment. You could see that things like Adingra was a coiled spring. He had his man on toast and they wouldn't play it to him. They played a high line and you're thinking, just play it over the top. And he's got his man every single time. And it's that decision-making at a given time which can be taught, but still has to be innate, still has to be part of your DNA. And I can't help feeling at the moment too many Albion players are playing within themselves.
When you see Fassi bearing in on goal, you kind of don't expect him to miss. And I mean, he had two chances in the first half. I mean, both of them were straight at Fodderingham. And, you know, we were talking about his punched finishes, but, you know, there was, sometimes if he just like lofted it or dinked it or like lifted it a little bit, it would have been a goal. You know, Gilmore had a couple of chances. Bonotti had a chance. Matoma, Pedro, they're all just like taking chances. If you think when you were talking about that game at Wolves, they're out, and you know, if you look at the team that we had out in that game, and you know, Purvis was playing, Solly was available, and Cisse was playing. Danny Welbeck was playing. Then, you know, these are all key players. And I think there are times where, I mean, you know, there's a reason why we've got a squad.
I totally get that. But I take your point. Yes, we've had injuries and therefore we're not necessarily playing with our first choice 11. But that starting 11 against Sheffield United was good enough to have got past their line and tucked away two or three goals. They're all Premier League professional footballers and know how to do it.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, and we can actually sit here and debate that. Point is that, ironically enough, if we'd have gone then and scored 2, 3 and 4 in the second half, we would have said, well, we're in total control. How good was that? It's just we were a bit nervous because this is about watching Brighton and you know sodding typical is about to happen. And if we'd have gone in 2-0 up, we'd have been purring. But, you know, that sign was good enough to have got past Sheffield United quite comfortably, and for whatever reason, it all unravelled in the second half.
Yeah, and Andy, second half there was two key incidents, and I know where you're sitting, what your opinion is, because I was sat next to you, and it's a family show, so I won't repeat exactly what you said. but basically, there was a VAR check for a penalty, which. Whichever way you look at it, should have been given. It was a it was a penalty on first sight and on multiple angles and everything else. It was still a penalty, and it wasn't given.
Yeah, it was clear. I still stand by my opinion about that from Sunday night. I might have changed my mind on the other incidents, but it's a clear penalty. I don't know. I mean, the ball's going across. His arm's out. It's moving towards the ball. It's the furthest part of his body that's away, and he stops the cross going in. I don't know. The handball rule is purely subjective. I wish they didn't, just didn't have it almost. I mean, it's so unevenly applied. Again, in the heat of the moment, I could understand the ref not giving it, given the speed of it and whatnot. But it wasn't like he was like 2 yards away. He was like 6-7 yards away. It was not a, he turned his back on it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a sort of thing that you'd actually been proud of to see in volleyball.
Yeah, clear penalty.
Well,
I don't know how you can look at a TV screen and not give it. It just seems insane to me.
Is his arm in the unnatural position? Yes. Is it part of his natural body?
He moved it towards the ball.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'd love to hear
he played the ball with his arm.
I'd love to hear the audio between referee and VAR for that. We were discussing it after the game, and I think we're probably, because I don't sit with AD and Andy, I sit with a couple of other people. I think our attitude is it's us and Gary, is Roberto Di Zerbi and Gary O'Neill are probably the two most put upon people by VAR by virtue of, I was reading a post on Facebook today. So for all the fact that we complain about X, Y, and Z, you know, there was an Arsenal fan that put up this big long post of outrageous VAR discrepancies, including the fact that Mope should have been sent off for ending Leno's career. And I think there was also the time when you think, well, hang on, what about the time when Martinelli absolutely flattened Kyrie Matoma? Because he also put up about Caicedo flattening Martinelli, and you think, well, why did he do that? So we've all got our gripes. And I'm sure that probably every single club has come under, an injustice from VAR. I think that the issue that Di Zerbi then raises about, he doesn't like 80% of English referees, which actually in its own right, I think is going to be one of those that will eventually end up on a T-shirt. I think you probably find that a lot of people may well agree with him. But I also can't help feeling that there's an element of a dead cat as a dead cat statement as well. For those who not sure what I'm talking about, it's the whole Boris Johnson thing of putting a dead cat in the middle of the table so you can talk about that rather than talking about the real issues. Because I also get the feeling that Di Zerbi really wasn't happy with the team's second half display.
So you think it's a little bit of deflecting then?
Yes. Yes. I mean, I'm sure he probably felt that before this game. And he's just had it proven. You're talking about we're talking about the second one, which sounds like you've done a bit of a 180 on. But the other sort of gripe I've got from, incidentally, the same referee who was the VAR at Selhurst Park last year and put the line in the wrong place for a Estupiñán's goal. I mean, and it got to the point where how many times has Estupiñán gonna score his first goal? he just point blank refused to book the Sheffield United players. Oliver Norwood, he returns to the Amex. It's probably not his first return. He really wanted to get sent off, didn't he?
Yeah. Yes. And this had not gone on commented on. Basically, there was two or three clear yellow card offences which he didn't even get pulled up for, and it was like, and we're seeing. I mean, well, I don't think any of this has got any arguments over the red card, have we? I mean, I didn't see it in real time.
You saw the replay.
Yeah, I've seen the replay now. Yeah,
yeah. It did lead one of my friends to actually say, when it comes to you two, the who could have come onto the pitch with an axe and chopped all the players' legs off and then headbutted them in a Woody Woodpecker style manner, and he still wouldn't be getting a red card, would he?
No. Come back here! I bite your legs off.
What you say, Al, the game has gone, mate. The game has gone. To be honest, no, I mean, because I watched, when we saw the replay in the concourse,
yeah,
to me it still looked innocuous. I didn't think there was any great force.
That was clumsy.
I don't think there was anything, any great force in what he did, and I still don't. But he did kick out at the guy. I think he made a meal of it. There was nothing wrong with him. He got up and he was running fine for the rest of the game. But yeah, it was a red card because it was a stupid thing to do. Most red cards were stupid things rather than actual hits.
Yeah. I think it was accidental more than anything. I don't think
sadly,
it was a shame because Dave was playing really well.
Yeah.
Best midfielder.
Hang on a sec. It's a red card that comes under violent conduct. So it's a three Premier League matches. So he can at least play in the next game, but just not the game after that.
I just don't think he was that violent, though.
No, it wasn't. No. It doesn't need to be. I mean, you know, you could actually argue about the one that we didn't get against Fulham, the elbow.
Yeah, that was violent. That was actual violent. In the street for that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, Al, I mean, there was a tie.
Free the Dahoud one.
So, but Al, I mean, there was a time where we were pretty much playing with 10 men every week. But it's not something that's happened for a very long time. This was our first red card since.
It was actually, I couldn't tell you exactly how many games. I think it's about 65. I'll have to check and put it out there. But it's since, not last season, but season before, Lewis Dunkup at Manchester United. That was our first playing squad red card. I shudder to think how many the manager's got in that time here and how many yellow cards he's got. But it's been a while since we've had a red card. And once upon a time, certainly under Gus, they used to train all the time 10 against 11 just because they kept on them getting sent off. And you couldn't help feeling those first 5-10 minutes after Dahoud got sent off, the players got into a little bit of a flap. They got into a little bit of a panic. And for me, that goal was still, because let's face it, it was sacrificed. It was Fatty. It wasn't Steele that was sacrificed. It wasn't Webster that was sacrificed. It was Fatty. It was a kind of a more of a forward player. That goal was still avoidable. I mean, obviously, Webster, if he hadn't kicked into the goal, there was a fella waiting to. But the build-up to it, they could have closed down better. It was almost as if, I won't say they were feeling sorry for themselves, but they did actually kind of stop a little bit.
Igor's got to be stopping that ball.
Yeah.
Getting in. And I think Igor's, really, apart from that one incident, I just think Igor's been fantastic. So I'm not going to criticise him. I'm not going to criticise the team on, not destructively. You could constructively point out the fact that, the shooting could have been better, which it should have been. And they got caught out there whilst I think they were mentally unsettled by the red card. But notwithstanding that, I mean, we still had enough in our locker to win that game. But I do think we are finding it tough, this schedule, because it's not just about the number of games that we're playing. It's what, we're playing these in like European competitions, and we're playing them at the top end of the Premier League, trying to get into the top eight, top six, top eight. And the pressure that goes with these games now, they're just bigger games for me. I think they're bigger games. I think they now know that they can achieve something, but it's really hard to do because we play in a very difficult league.
Conversely, what I would say is that, as opposed to someone like Burnley when they played in the in Europe and
against Aberdeen, against Aberdeen, that was their one game
when they played. But then even when West Ham did quite well in Europe, their league form suffered. Now at the moment, our league form isn't as good as it could be. I think Andy Naylor said we're on our worst run, and our worst run is one defeat. You could say it's only one win, but it's still one defeat. We're drawing. Hello, the ghost of Potter is back. But the point is, and I was making this point on the Anfield Wrap though when I was on it this week, is that this is now our third season where we're trying to sustain ourselves as a top 10 club. What we haven't done is sacrifice every single aspect of our Premier League form. we're not getting the results we could do. We should have got something more against Fulham. We should have got something more against Sheffield United. We were always going to get stuffed against Aston Villa. So we probably we could be 5 or 6 points better off. But the point is, here we are in eighth. And let's face it, rewind 2 years, for us to be sustainably in eighth place, you'd have bitten your arm off for it. So for the fact we were actually in a decent position in Europe as we stand, we're in a reasonable position in the Premier League, we're not doing too badly. The consolidation season that Stephen Grant was talking about on the show last week, I think is working okay. Yeah, we've just got to be a bit patient. We know we can do better. The players know they can do better. And I think De Zerbi expects them to do better, which is great. And for me, the international break can't have come a moment too soon.
Yeah, Andy, we want to get some of these walking wounded back out on the pitch and back out and play. I mean, I'm not quite sure how long Cizo is going to be away for. I'm not sure how long Welbeck's going to be away for. Still haven't had any news on Solly March. These are all big players for us last season, and integral to the way that we actually play. So to have so many missing, I mean, Purvis's opinion, another one. When he affects the way that we play massively because we can play a lot further up the pitch when he's there. These are the big players missing.
Yeah, they are, and so what we do is apart from Purvis, who we don't really have a like for like replacement for, which is a problem for Roberto to have to deal with. When he's put in the square pegs and round holes in that left back position, but with other players, I mean, now like Odinga is now going to be a regular.
He's starting every game at the moment.
You know what? I do not have a problem with that. Right at this particular moment in time, I'm kind of all right with it. You've also, Gilmore's becoming more established, like Fatty and Pedro, providing a nice little new, forward partnership. So, we are getting a lot out of this. Van Hecker's come in now and established himself, I think, as the second on the depth chart when it comes to centre-halves after Lewis. Igor's now getting more game time than he would have been had everybody been fit, and he looks a terrific player as well. We are kind of like figuring this all out on the go, and I think we're doing a pretty good job of it, to be honest. I don't think we're getting enough credit for it. I mean, we haven't lost a game after a European match thus far, which I think is a pretty good run. I remember, we would always play like Arsenal. We played Arsenal on a Sunday. We think, oh, we've got a really good chance against them because, they just played their Europa League or their Champions League game this week, although they've got one coming up, So, and we would normally do well in those games. And now we're in their position and we still haven't lost. We gussed it out. It was what it was Sunday.
Because that's all we've got time for this week. So thank you so much, of course, to Andy Bass. Thank you to Alan Wares. I've been Eddie Packham. This has been the Albion Roar on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and, of course, on our podcast and in association with oldfootballshirts.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you all again next week. Cheers. Bye.